We're going to read now from a Jack Anderson column about Jesse Jackson's behavior. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of June 23rd of 1987. This story is about, it's called Jackson's Claim to Fame. Oh, this story, this column by Jack Anderson is headlined or titled by the Chronicle, Jackson's Claim to Fame, and it reads as follows. The Reverend Jesse Jackson's emergence in the front of the pack of the Democratic presidential race is widely attributed to his greater name recognition. Jackson became a media star within hours of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King on April 4, 1968. Jackson was only 26, a junior member of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was part of King's party in Memphis, Tennessee on the fatal day. Jackson's actions and the media's instant lionizing of him still mystify some of King's old associates after 19 years. He flew home to Chicago within hours after the assassination. Quote, we saw him on TV at the Midway Airport in Chicago doing a press conference on the tarmac, recalled the Reverend Bernard Lee, then a special assistant to King, and now an aide to Washington Mayor Marion Barry. Quote, all of us were surprised to see him doing a press conference. He had some blood on his shirt saying, this is Dr. King's blood, unquote. I personally did not see him touch Dr. King. Another SCLC leader interviewed by our reporter Lisa Sylvester was the Reverend Hosea Williams, now a member of the Atlanta City Council. Quote, Jesse was talking to the press out in the yard after we were sure Dr. King was absolutely dead, he recalled. Jesse was talking to the press and showed them the blood on his shirt, and I know the blood didn't come from Dr. King. I reacted very violently, unquote. Williams attributes Jackson's actions at the time to his youth. Quote, I feel very bad about it, unquote, Williams said. Quote, he was just a young man and made a mistake. It could hurt him. Again, end quote. The Reverend Ralph David Abernathy, who succeeded King as head of the SCLC, expressed a similar view. Abernathy, who was the first to reach King's side when he fell to the floor of the motel balcony, said he has heard of press accounts saying Jackson was the first to reach the fallen leader and the last person to talk to him. Abernathy and Williams both recall Jackson being in the motel courtyard near the balcony when the fatal shot was fired, but they have no recollection that he reached King's side. Yet the news account in the Chicago Defender of April 8, 1968 said, quote, Jackson said he rushed to Dr. King's side immediately, but got no response when he asked, Doc, can you hear me, unquote. We called Jackson's campaign office for comment. His press aide, Frank Watkins, said Jackson makes no claim that he spoke with King after the shooting. But he did, however, claim, or he claimed for a long time, he no longer apparently claims, that he cradled the dying Dr. King's head. This account had been a subject of a lot of controversy and had alienated, among others, Dr. King's widow, Coretta King, from Jesse Jackson. It's worth noting that in the spring, or perhaps early summer of 1988, in an appearance on the Phil Donahue Show, Jesse Jackson changed the account of his behavior on the day of the assassination of Martin Luther King. He changed the account that he's basically stuck to for 20 years. He now claims basically that he didn't cradle the dying Dr. King's head, but that there was blood all over the place, and that's how he got the blood on his shirt. Again, why he would change his story after 20 years is a subject for speculation, as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. Should also be noted, and again, we will be coming back to this in an archive show about Jesse Jackson, that shortly before Dr. King's assassination, he was contemplating basically getting rid of Jesse Jackson. He indicated that he felt that Jesse was going to have to make his own impression in the world and his own mark on society. We'll go into that in a future archive show about Jesse Jackson. But bear in mind where Jesse was. In effect, Dr. King came out to his death in order to talk to Dr. Jackson, or to talk to Jesse Jackson, but Jesse's down on the down on the courtyard below the balcony, and there's no indication that he cradled the dying Dr. King's head. The question is, where did Jesse get that shirt? And where was the blood real? Did he know in advance? There are a lot of questions here that need to be answered. Still more curious behavior by Jesse Jackson with regard to the assassination of Dr. King occurred shortly after the 1988 presidential election. Reading a short section now from an article in the San Francisco Chronicle on Thursday, December 1st of 1988. This is an article by Larry Liebert of the Chronicle Washington Bureau, Dateline Washington headline, Bush and Jackson Meet, and They Get Along. Just going to read you a short section of this particular article. Jackson also asked Bush to use his influence to prevent parole for James Earl Ray, who murdered civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. Bush said later that a reported proposal to release Ray, quote, would send the wrong signal to America, unquote. That last couple of sentences again. Jackson also asked Bush to use his influence to prevent parole for James Earl Ray, who murdered, this should be allegedly murdered, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. Bush said later that a reported proposal to release Ray would, quote, send the wrong signal to America, unquote. Well, as we've seen, James Earl Ray was demonstrably innocent. It's difficult to believe that Jesse Jackson doesn't know that at this point. Most of the people around Dr. King do. It's also worth noting that after the vicious racist campaign that George Bush ran, former CIA director George Bush, Jesse was able to get along with him just fine. Further note there, and again, we're going to take this up at greater length in a future archive show about Jesse. Reading now from the San Francisco Examiner from that same day, Thursday, to December 1st of 1988, this is an article by Janet Cawley of the Chicago Tribune, headlined, Bush and Jackson Mending Fences, and I'm just going to read you a short section of it. Before the two began their lunch at the old executive office building, Bush said he would be, quote, seeking advice, unquote, from Jackson, and added again, quoting, nobody is going to believe it, and I give Reverend Jackson the right to deny it, but we have had a relationship that transcends politics and addresses itself to national issues. Well, again, nobody is going to be quoting this again. Nobody is going to believe it, and I give Reverend Jackson the right to deny it, but we have had a relationship that transcends politics and addresses itself to national issues. Jesse didn't deny it. One wonders perhaps whether one of the things that binds them is murder. Obviously speculation, but one truly does wonder under the circumstances. Again, the fact that Jesse changed his story after all this time is worth noting. Apparently, he was lying, and it's not the best recommendation in the world. And obviously, James Earl Ray is demonstrably innocent. He didn't kill Dr. King or anybody else. So, a lot of questions, I think, need to be asked about Jesse Jackson and his behavior with regard to the assassination of Dr. King. It's a matter of public record that the FBI wanted to head American blacks, and the national security establishment in general wanted to head American blacks in a different direction from the one Dr. King was taking them in. And again, we'll talk about this in a future broadcast. One wonders if perhaps Jesse was the chosen man. Obviously, not a conclusion we can draw, but I think it's a question we have to ask. Here we have him arguing against the parole of a demonstrably innocent man, and in effect, with that act, he began, whether or not he was involved before, he became, for all practical purposes, an accessory to the assassination of Dr. King by helping to cover it up, even after all these many years. So again, it's worth speculating about just what Jesse's situation was and is, and I think we're going to be coming back to this particular speech, I think by way of reflecting on Jesse Jackson, his role with regard to the assassination of Martin Luther King, and his role as the political spear carrier and front runner at this point for the 1992 Democratic presidential nomination. We're going to listen to one of Dr. King's best and most famous speeches, and it's certainly worth thinking about in terms of Jesse Jackson and his situation. We're going to listen to the drum major instinct and what Dr. King had to say about that. Interesting to think about Jesse Jackson in this context.
This morning I would like to use as a subject from which to preach the drum major instinct. The drum major instinct. And our text for the morning is taken from a very familiar passage in the 10th chapter as recorded by St. Mark, beginning with the 35th verse of that chapter, we read these words, and James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came unto him, saying, Master, we would that thou shouldest do for us whatsoever we shall desire. And he said unto them, What would ye that I should do for you? And they said unto him, grant unto us that we may sit one on thy right hand and the other on thy left hand in thy glory. But Jesus said unto them, ye know not what ye ask. Can ye drink of the cup that I drink of and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said unto him, we can. And Jesus said unto them, ye shall indeed drink of the cup that I drink of, and with the baptism that I am baptized withal shall ye be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared. And then Jesus goes on toward the end of that passage to say, but so shall it not be among you, but whosoever will be great among you shall be your servant, and whosoever of you will be the chiefest shall be servant of all. The setting is clear. James and John are making a specific request of the Master. They had dreamed, as most of the Hebrews dreamed, of a coming king of Israel who would set Jerusalem free and establish his kingdom on Mount Zion and in righteousness rule the world. And they thought of Jesus as this kind of king, and they were thinking of that day when Jesus would reign supreme as this new king of Israel. And they were saying, now, when you establish your kingdom, let one of us sit on the right hand and the other on the left hand of your throne. Now, very quickly, we would automatically condemn James and John, and we would say they were selfish. Why would they make such a selfish request? But before we condemn them too quickly, let us look calmly and honestly at ourselves, and we will discover that we too have those same basic desires for recognition, for importance, that same desire for attention, that same desire to be first. Of course, the other disciples got mad with James and John, and you could understand why, but we must understand that we have some of the same James and John qualities. And that is deep down within all of us, an instinct. It's a kind of drum major instinct, a desire to be out front, a desire to lead the parade, a desire to be first. And it is something that runs the whole gamut of life. And so before we condemn them, let us see that we all have the drum major instinct. We all want to be important, to surpass others, to achieve distinction, to lead the parade. Alfred Adler, the great psychoanalyst, contends that this is the dominant impulse. Sigmund Freud used to contend that Sex was the dominant impulse, and Adler came with a new argument, saying that this quest for recognition, this desire for attention, this desire for distinction is the basic impulse, the basic drive of human life, this drum major instinct. And you know, we begin early to ask life to put us first. Our first cry as a baby was a bid for attention. And all through childhood, the drum major impulse or instinct is a major obsession. Children ask life to grant them first place. They are a little bundle of ego. They have innately the drum major instinct. Now, in adult life, we still have it, and we really never get by it. We like to do something good, and you know, we like to be praised for it. Now, if you don't believe that, you just go on living life and you will discover very soon that you like to be praised. Everybody likes it, as a matter of fact. And somehow this warm glow we feel when we are praised or when our name is in print is something of the vitamin A to our ego. Nobody is unhappy when they are praised, even if they know they don't deserve it, and even if they don't believe it. The only unhappy people about praise is when that praise is going too much towards somebody else. But everybody likes to be praised because of this real drum major instinct. Do you know that a lot of the race problem grows out of the drum major instinct? A need that some people have to feel superior. A need that some people have to feel that they are first, and to feel that their white skin ordained them to be first. And they have said over and over again, in ways that we see with our own eyes. In fact, not too long ago, a man down in Mississippi said that God was a charter member of the White Citizens Council. And so, God being the charter member means that everybody who's in that has a kind of divinity, a kind of superiority. And think of what has happened in history as a result of this perverted use of the drum major instinct. Has led to the most tragic prejudice, the most tragic expressions of man's inhumanity to man. I mean, not only does this thing go into the racial struggle, it goes into the struggle between nations. And I would submit to you this morning that what is wrong in the world today is that the nations of the world are engaged in a bitter, colossal contest for supremacy. And if something doesn't happen to stop this trend, I'm sorely afraid that we won't be here to talk about Jesus Christ and about God and about brotherhood too many more years. If somebody doesn't bring an end to this suicidal thrust that we see in the world today, none of us are going to be around, because somebody's going to make the mistake through our senseless blunderings of dropping a nuclear bomb somewhere, and then another one is going to drop. And don't let anybody fool you. This can happen within a matter of seconds. They have 20 megaton bombs in Russia right now that can destroy a city as big as New York in 3 seconds, with everybody wiped away and every building. And we can do the same thing to Russia and China. But this is why we are drifting, and we are drifting there. Because nations are caught up with the drum major instinct. I must be first. I must be supreme. Our nation must rule the world. And I am sad to say that the nation in which we live is the supreme culprit. And I'm going to continue to say it to America. Because I love this country too much to see the drift that it has taken. God didn't call America to do what she's doing in the world now. God didn't call America to engage in a senseless, unjust war as the war in Vietnam. And we are criminals in that war. We've committed more war crimes almost than any nation in the world. And I'm going to continue to say it. And we won't stop it because of our pride and our arrogance as a nation. But God has a way of even putting nations in their place. Yeah. The God that I worship has a way of saying, don't play with me. He has a way of saying, as the God of the Old Testament used to say, to the Hebrews, don't play with me, Israel. Don't play with me, Babylon. Yeah. Be still and know that I'm God. If you don't stop your reckless course, I'll rise up and break the backbone of your power. Yes. And that can happen to America. Yes. Every now and then I go back and read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And when I come and look at America, I say to myself, the parallels are frightening. We have perverted the drum major instinct. But let me rush on to my conclusion, because I want you to see what Jesus was really saying. What was the answer that Jesus gave these men? It's very interesting. One would have thought that Jesus would have condemned them. One would have thought that Jesus would have said, you are out of your place. You are selfish. Why would you raise such a question? But that isn't what Jesus did. He did something altogether different. He said in substance, oh, I see. You want to be first? You want to be great? You want to be important? You want to be significant? Well, you ought to be. If you're going to be my disciple, you must be. But he reordered priorities. And he said, yes, don't give up this instinct. It's a good instinct if you use it right. Yes. It's a good instinct if you don't distort it and pervert it. Don't give it up. Keep feeling the need for being important. Keep feeling the need for being first. But I want you to be first in love. I want you to be first in moral excellence. I want you to be first in generosity. That is what I want you to do. And he transformed the situation by giving a new definition of greatness. And you know how he said it? He said, now, brethren, I can't give you greatness. And really, I can't make you first. This is what Jesus said to James and John. You must earn it. True greatness comes not by favoritism, but by fitness. And the right hand and the left are not mine to give. They belong to those who are prepared. Yes. And so Jesus gave us a new norm of greatness. If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness. this morning, the thing that I like about it. By giving that definition of greatness, it means that everybody can be great. Because everybody can serve. Every now and then, I guess we all think realistically about that day when we will be victimized with what is life's final common denominator. That's something that we call death. We all think about it, and every now and then I think about my own death, and I think about my own funeral, and I don't think of it in a morbid sense. Every now and then I ask myself, what is it that I would want said? And I leave the word to you this morning. If any of you are around when I have to meet my day, I don't want a long funeral. And if you get somebody to deliver the eulogy, tell them not to talk too long. Every now and then I wonder what I want them to say. Tell them not to mention that I have a Nobel Peace Prize. That isn't important. Tell them not to mention that I have 300 or 400 other awards. That's not important. Tell them not to mention where I went to school. I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving others. I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. I want you to say that day that I tried to be right on the war question. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try to feed the hungry. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try in my life to clothe those who were naked. I want you to say on that day that I did try in my life to visit those who were in prison. I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. Yes, if you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness. And all of the other shallow things will not matter. I won't have any money to leave behind. I won't have the fine and luxurious things of life to leave behind. But I just want to leave a committed life behind. And that's all I want to say. If I can help somebody as I pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a word of song, if I can show somebody he's traveling wrong, then my living will not be in vain. If I can do my duty as a Christian ought, if I can bring salvation to a world once wrought, if I can spread the message as the Master taught, then my living will not be in vain. Yes, Jesus, I want to be on your right or your left side. Not for any selfish reason. I want to be on your right or your left side, not in terms of some political kingdom or ambition, but I just want to be there in love and in justice and in truth.
3.
Well, good evening. Welcome back to Radio Free America. The broadcast now concluded. That a bit of visionary music, I guess you could say, from Todd Rundgren, the last of the New Wave Riders, at any rate. That winds up Radio Free America for this evening, including an addendum. The addendum is going into the archives on permanent basis. And again, forgive me for repeating some information there, but I thought that would be useful in order to help help refresh people's memory vis-a-vis the physical setup in Memphis, Tennessee.